It's been an exciting few years in Scottish politics.
Did you hear that? Now there is the authentic voice. Get back to England. I'll go wherever I like, Buster, whether you like it or not.
And compared with the high emotion of the referendum, devolution can seem like a lukewarm or decaffeinated version of the real thing.
To find a way of adjusting the block grant for Scotland, both to take into account the new Scottish responsibilities, so there'll be some extra items of spending.
I'm Dr. Scott Hames, and I teach Scottish literature at the University of Stirling. This podcast explores the story of Scottish devolution and why it's so difficult to tell. Here is the most important political change of the past half century, and we have no cohesive way of explaining it. There is no widely accepted story that makes emotional and historical sense out of how we got to where we are. Does this matter? I'm especially interested in efforts to explain political change with reference to cultural change. Here's how news of the 1997 referendum was welcomed by the BBC's Reporting Scotland.
Well, it's not only politicians who are coming to terms with the prospect of a seat of power in the capital. Many writers and historians believe it could mark the beginning of a Scottish cultural renaissance.
On this view, a new Scottish Parliament will act as a starting pistol for cultural rebirth. But in fact, it's the opposite view which has become most influential. According to this story, devolution is the outcome, not the genesis, of a cultural movement stretching back several decades. Writers such as Alistair Gray, Liz Lockhead, and Edwin Morgan are presented as a kind of literary vanguard. The poet Kathleen Jamie recalls the role of artists in making Holyrood possible.
Possibly for historical reasons, there was a time until very recently when Scotland had no parliament. It was only 15 years old, and so much of the work, the political work, having no political place, so much of that devolved to the artists to do, right up until 1997. You know, the devolution campaign, that was largely driven by the artists, just because there was nobody else.
This view powerfully shapes how we understand the relationship between Scottish culture and Scottish politics. On one hand, it tends to limit the politics of Scottish art to the politics of identity and representation. On the other, it gives an appealing cultural gloss to the history of devolution, portraying it as a passionate creative project rooted in artistic dissent. This emphasis allows us to forget the less inspiring machinations on the road to 1997. Culture really was a central factor in the politics of devolution, but the story is less uplifting than it first appears. James Kelman is one of the most influential Scottish writers of our time. Where others see Holyrood as a symbol of cultural liberation, Kelman sees a profoundly limited state reform.
Many believe that to engage in the parliamentary process will help us along the road to freedom. I don't hold that position.
Let's begin by facing up to the more dismal aspect of devolution. It's a fairly murky and unappealing notion, reeking of pragmatic compromise. Devolution isn't sexy, but it is remarkably popular. Professor Adam Tompkins of the University of Glasgow.
But what we did on the 18th of September was we voted not just against independence, but for more devolution. Only about 9 or 10% of people every year polled by the Scottish Social Attitudes Survey are unhappy about devolution, want less devolution rather than more of it. So 90% of Scots like devolution and either like it as it is or want more of it. Devolution is a wildly popular idea.
Professor Tompkins was a prominent no campaigner, and it should be obvious that the politics of 2014 profoundly color our sense of what devolution means and what it's for. And here is the first paradox we encounter. Devolution is the consensus position in Scottish politics, but it means very different and contradictory things to its supporters. Generally speaking, Scotland likes devolution, or the idea of devolution, without really understanding it. Professor Paul Kearney of the University of Stirling recalls the early years of Holyrood.
I was going to say devolution in those early days was generally seen as a success, but that's not quite true. If you look at opinion polls on, you know, how well has the Scottish Parliament been doing, there's a real sense of ambivalence or disinterest. You know, they couldn't bring themselves to say this was a good thing. But it was seen as a success in a sense that any time that people identified failure of devolution, the solution was more devolution.
I'm often struck by the mismatch between the obvious importance of devolution and our uncertainty about how it works or where it came from. Ours is the age of devolution, but we seem incurious about what that really means. As for the term,
devolution is an ugly word. No one really knows what it means. It's a word that doesn't have any kind of common currency. It's a bit of jargon. I would love to call it home rule rather than devolution. I'm a home ruler.
So devolution is both popular and unloved, even by its biggest fans. Only a tiny handful of experts really understand devolution. To the vast majority, this scheme for bringing power closer to the people is completely opaque. What is more, almost nobody is truly devoted to the idea or to the policy. As a stepping stone to independence, or as a means of killing nationalism stone dead, devolution has its adherents, but only as a means to an end, or as a chapter in some larger story. What is the story of devolution itself? Since it's the political air we breathe, shouldn't we know? There is only one serious attempt to tell the story of devolution, and it comes from the domain of fiction. James Robertson's End the Land Lay Still is a panoramic social novel charting 6 decades of political change in Scotland. Having been politically active in the 1980s, Robertson began with debates he had experienced firsthand.
What I found very quickly was that I couldn't tell the story of the devolution years, if you like, the period from 79 to 97, simply by telling the story in that period. What I had to do was go further back, and what I eventually found was I had to go right back to the 1950s, because the story I was trying to tell, and the story that I think is the story of how we got from where we were to where we are, is this contest between Scottishness and Britishness. 1950 is when it seems to me that Scotland was as tied into the British project, into the British state, as it ever was. You're talking 5 years after the end of the war, the United War against Germany. You are then talking about the sort of renewal of Britishness through the Labour government of 45 to 50, the idea that Britishness has a sort of something new and better to give to people through the establishment of the welfare state and particularly the National Health Service. But you also have a period where the empire still exists but is about to be dismantled. So I think there are lots and lots of reasons why people in Scotland are still very tied into the British project and the idea of a united British state. All of that begins to disintegrate for lots and lots of reasons from the 60s onwards, and because there is a modernised sense of Scottishness taking shape in that at the same time, that actually gives people somewhere to go when they can no longer feel at home within that sense of Britishness.
Robertson holds a PhD in history, and the backward momentum of his story is suggestive. The novel reaches further and further back to understand where we are now. And the Land Lay Still is chock full of historical exposition and occasionally strains to fill in large gaps in the reader's assumed knowledge. Knowledge of what are, after all, fairly recent events. That pattern of reaching further back fits with the most influential story of devolution, one focused on the retrieval and recovery of Scottish identity. Many writers and critics argue that political devolution was made possible by cultural devolution. After the failure of the 1979 referendum, the story goes, Scottish artists raced ahead of the politicians. A culture of self-determination would pave the way for self-government. Professor Rory Watson sees the Parliament building itself, including the literary quotations built into the Canongate Wall, as part of this resurgence.
I think Holyrood is itself an expression of the rise in cultural and political confidence that gave birth to Holyrood. So there's a way in which it is riding on the back of that, I think, and is part of the same expression.
Perhaps you suspect the literati of inflating their political importance. But an impressive number of senior politicians tell the same tale. The second presiding officer of the new Parliament, George Reid MSP, boils down the story of devolution to the slogan, art first, politics later. Professor Cairns Craig of the University of Aberdeen was a key figure in these developments. For Craig, devolution was made not by politicians or Whitehall, but in the cramped Edinburgh offices of magazines such as Radical Scotland, Ken Crastus, and New Edinburgh Review.
You've got an awareness of the Scottish past that simply was not available to anybody in 1979. And this, it seems to me, was a very deliberate political campaign through culture to transform the perceptions of Scottish people. The analysis which those of us who were involved in Ken Crastus magazine made in 1979 was that the Scottish people could not vote for their own parliament because they had no sense of their own history or of their own culture, and they had no valuation of their own culture.
The recovery of the past is the key shift since the 1980s. Democratic empowerment required a solid platform of cultural self-knowledge.
What it seems to me we were doing was actually providing the cultural infrastructure which would make it possible for people to exert the will that would become settled, because they would actually have a background against which to see their own actions.
The idea of cultural infrastructure may seem rather abstract, but it connects directly to our lived realities and the intimate force of identity.
But I don't remember anybody in my primary school who didn't write North Britain on their school book.
Jean Urquhart is MSP for the Highlands and Islands. She remembers the dominance of British identity in the 1950s and the strength of the Scottish cringe.
But it seems everything that I learned about the country that I lived in was out with the education system that I experienced. I'm not saying that was everywhere, although I have met a lot of people who identify with that. By the time I was going into secondary school, my feeling about Scotland was that I really couldn't stand the place. I thought it was awful. I thought everything about it was terrible. The tartan, folk songs, or the whiskey. Just, I didn't like it. I wanted to leave. And so did a lot of other people.
Jean did leave at 16. But after a period working in London, she returned to Glasgow and began to discover the Scotland she'd been missing. She did so not through school books, but by direct involvement with the burgeoning cultural scene of the late 1960s.
I became aware of lots of things. I was on the board of the Citizens Theatre by the time I was 19 and was completely involved in a discovery, absolute discovery of my country.
By 1997, the prospect of real democratic power returning to Scotland was routinely viewed in these terms. A BBC report on the referendum result of 1997 asks whether the new parliament will strengthen Scottish culture, but then reverses its terms.
Despite the recent efforts of writers and filmmakers, it is the traditional images of Scottish culture which dominate the world's imagination. But many people believe a new parliament will lead to the rebirth of Scottish culture. Others believe the Renaissance has already happened, that the growing confidence in Scottish culture is just part of a nationwide confidence.
Scots, I think, have been bedeviled because of the political limbo they were living in by self-doubt for a long time. And the self-doubts will resurrect from time to time, but it will be in a context of belief that we can do the things we want to do and achieve the kind of society we want to achieve.
Whether beginning or simply continuing a cultural renaissance, Scotland clearly has a captive audience. Pauline MacLean, reporting Scotland.
In that clip, the late William McIlvany sees devolution as Scotland returning to itself, both culturally and politically. But this is not the whole story. Nearly two decades later, we often overlook the British dimension of devolution.
This is a good day for Scotland, and it's a good day for Britain and the United Kingdom too. We said, trust the people. We did trust the people. And the people have had the courage and the confidence to trust themselves.
In accounting for devolution, historians and social scientists tend to place less importance on Scottish cultural renewal. Katrina MacDonald of the University of Glasgow.
It was, of course, a British government that delivered devolution. And here we hit on the Scottish-UK interface that I would suggest usually takes a back seat when it comes to cultural analyses of 97, which are often very Scotocentric. It was what Scottish voters had in common with voters across the UK that delivered regime change in 1997, not the differences. And it was this regime, based in Whitehall, led by a privileged Scot, that delivered the referendum, not poems in short-lived literary journals, not touring productions of low-budget, angry plays, not folk laments. Identities defined in part by economics, rather, I would suggest, than nationality, were mobilised in 1997, and arguably the rest came down to cephalogical aberrations that saw solid Tory seats go Labour for reasons that were far removed from the ideals of the Scottish literati. Indeed, one interpretation of the 97 referendum was that it proved the union was actually working. It was a very British solution to an acknowledged domestic problem that I would say Scottish Tories in the 50s would have had very little difficulty in appreciating. After all, the levers of power were retained at Westminster, and political power remained in the hands of the usual suspects.
And yet, those Scottish Tories of the 1950s, whose party was still known as the Unionist Party, would have been horrified by any solution which could yet lead to the breakup of Britain. This brings us to perhaps the central irony of the tale. Devolution played midwife to the independence referendum, despite being expressly designed as a prophylactic against nationalism. Devolution was a child of electoral expedience from the start. It was nobody's dream and nobody's shining cause. From its origins in the late 1960s, when Harold Wilson's Labour government grew alarmed at the rise of the SNP, its logic was tactical rather than strategic. The policy was driven as much by the need to appear to do something as by any principled conviction about what devolution was for. In 1968, Wilson announced the Royal Commission on the Constitution and charged it with meeting the British people's, quote, greater desire for participation in the process of decision-making. In truth, Wilson was reacting to the almighty scare of November 1967, when Labour famously lost one of its safest Scottish seats to Winnie Ewing and the SNP.
Winning Hamilton is something I could never forget. The whole crowd was pouring rain for hours, and the whole crowd was mine. Once I won, people couldn't believe it.
If we look at its internal documents, it's clear that the Royal Commission understands its role as helping the government to combat nationalism in Scotland and Wales. But this couldn't be stated too openly. The Labour government was wary of seeming to offer sops to nationalist voters, and instead presented devolution as a scheme to modernise British government across the board, seeking to reduce a growing sense of distance between rulers and ruled. The SNP treated the Royal Commission with great suspicion. Its official submission describes the Commission as a, quote, defensive reaction to growing support for independence, intended only to placate and arrest the rise of national feeling. There is a great deal of truth in this charge. Several of the Commission's members were hostile to any appeasement of nationalism, notably its initial chair. Former SNP leader Gordon Wilson.
Lord Crowther said, I'm a Yorkshireman, I'm as independent as you. The inference being that Scotland was a region of the United Kingdom on an elevated position like Yorkshire. And I showed you the bias that had been built into the Commission, but fate works in strange ways, and Lord Crowther died prematurely, leaving Lord Colbrandon. Now, most Scottish judges would be very strong unionists, but Lord Colbrandon was an original thinker and very pro-Scottish. So when it reported it was in favour of a devolved Scottish Assembly, it came at a critical time, and that critical time was the Govan by-election where Margo MacDonald was elected.
And I declare that Margo MacDonald has been duly elected.
After the Colbrandon report and the Govan shock, devolution moved to the centre of Scottish politics, where it split the Labour Party down the middle.
The Labour Party in Scotland do not accept some type of devolution, then these workers are going to turn from us and turn to the SNP.
That was Alex Ferry of the Amalgamated Engineering Union, speaking in devolution's banner year of 1974. There were, of course, two general elections that year. In the first, Labour were against devolution, and in the second, they supported it. What happened between were further gains for the SNP and a famous Labour U-turn. After furious internal debate, a sparsely attended meeting of Labour's Scottish Executive voted narrowly against reversing its opposition to devolution. The Economist noted that the reversal had been, quote, acutely embarrassing for Mr. Wilson, who is anxious to palm the Scots off with any amount of devolution which will keep them quiet. A few weeks later, Labour HQ in London effectively imposed a pro-devolution stance on a reluctant and bitterly divided Scottish Labour. It became known as the Dalyntober Street Fix, after the location of the second meeting. After Wilson's narrow majority in the second election of 1974, work on devolution began in earnest. As the Whitehall machinery cranked into gear, the implications of a hastily drafted policy began to become clear. One briefing paper states, with mild alarm, that, quote, the economic case for maintaining the unity of the United Kingdom is not easy to demonstrate, but it would be desirable to argue in any white paper that it was to Scotland's benefit to remain within the United Kingdom. Much to their own discomfort, the Whitehall civil servants of 1974 were, in fact, rehearsing the town hall debates of 2014. Paradoxically, a reform designed to end all talk of Scottish independence made that prospect very real to those drafting the policy in central government. Arguably, Scottish independence seemed much more real to these 70s bureaucrats than it would to Scottish voters for a further four decades. Just before the 1979 referendum on a Scottish Assembly, the Prime Minister James Callaghan addressed a Scottish audience. He said, Parliament at Westminster will remain sovereign. Nothing will undo that. But there's room for much diversity within that sovereignty. And if you wish it, an elected assembly is yours for the taking. If you do so, and I would encourage you, in the belief that a yes vote is good for Scotland, and certainly not harmful to the rest of us. His tone here gives you a sense of why pro-devolution campaigners expressed polite concern that the government's commitment seemed half-hearted. Certainly not harmful to the rest of us is hardly a ringing endorsement for reforming and strengthening the UK. The lack of popular engagement and popular interest in devolution is significant. In many respects, devolution was a fix by party elites, seeking to navigate the electoral problem presented by the rising SNP. Some feel that the aftermath of the 2014 referendum is taking a similar path. The rowdy street politics and face paint of the Indy Ref gave way to the Smith Commission, which saw 10 politicians shape the next phase of devolution behind closed doors. Public involvement was close to nil, and there are as yet no stirring folk songs on the devolution of discretionary housing payments. In the 1970s, only a tiny elite took any part in shaping the policy. Adam Tompkins hears clear echoes of the Kilbrandon report today.
Some of those Whitehall-isms about the understanding of decentralisation, devolution, federalism from the 1970s are exactly what you still hear now, 40 years on, in terms of the way in which Whitehall, specifically Whitehall, I don't mean ministers, I don't mean parliament, I don't mean political parties, I mean Whitehall, I mean senior civil servants in the United Kingdom government understand devolution. That's to say, they don't understand it at all. One of the reasons why devolution has been so smooth and so successful is because it has actually had very little impact on the way in which the British government does its business.
But the technocratic side of devolution is only half the story. Devolution began, we should recall, as a response to forces much closer to the colourful and emotional qualities of the independence debate. Indeed, the power of cultural identity is a major preoccupation of the Royal Commission back in the 1970s. The Kilbrandon Report has an entire chapter on national feeling, and recommends devolution as, quote, an appropriate means of recognising Scotland's national identity and of giving expression to its national consciousness. In this respect, the Whitehall blueprint for devolution seems to match the story of cultural devolution, but with an important difference. With Kilbrandon, the aim is to corral and neuter the force of identity by creating new government institutions to contain it. National feeling can then be recognized on terms less threatening to the existing political order. In this respect, devolution is a state project for the management of national feeling.
I do not trust these positions on Scottishness. I don't trust them. It doesn't mean I'm not in favour of independence. What is Scottishness? This thing that we are supposed to share or be identified by, what is it? The idea that I shall stand shoulder to shoulder with the ruling class in behalf of and in defence of Scottishness is ludicrous.
From this point of view, there is nothing subversive about banging the drum for Scottishness. Devolution has made this obvious. Today, the politics of Scottish difference pose a challenge to one government while securing the dominance of another. Even before devolution, the politics of national feeling were about more than the struggle for cultural confidence. Questions of Scottishness were deeply enmeshed with economic and political conflict. Katrina MacDonald rejects the story of a cultural vanguard.
I would totally disagree with the fact that any artist, named, unnamed or imaginary, generated what was necessary to ground the Scottish Parliament. I think if you ask a majority of Scots, that would not be something that they would remotely bring to the table. That's not to say, however, that art was not important, but it was not determining. And I think we have to keep... I think the riches of cultural discussion and debate about that period are to be found in looking at how it nurtured or emphasised certain aspects of a cultural reawakening that's more broadly conceived, but far more profound was the economic dislocation of the previous 20 years, the post-Thatcher period in Scotland, a period when unemployment was skyrocketing, when former icons of Scotland's proud industrial past were eroding, were getting closed down, when things we had told ourselves about who we were as a nation suddenly were counting for naught when it came to the British state. You can point even in other terms at our martial tradition. If you think about the Scottish regiments, one after the other, they get amalgamated and then eventually, somehow or other, they seem to disappear. So the narrative of empire, the narrative of the welfare state, the narrative of Scotland as part of a British settlement in which Scottishness was valued, all of those things at once came into question. Did culture determine that? No, it didn't. But cultural commentators, artists, movie makers, musicians all had a part to play.
Here we come to the crux of the matter, how key planks of Scottish cultural identity were affected by the seismic political and economic change of the 1980s. The pro-devolution momentum built up by the early 1990s reflected the disenchantment of Scottish voters fed up with a government that seemed hostile to how Scotland had come to understand itself. Cultural assertions of Scottishness in the late 80s and early 90s, in literature, in music, in art, quickly made the rejection of Thatcherism a touchstone of national belonging. Alex Salmond.
There's always been a Scottish identity, but to give that identity political form and substance is very important. Some events out with our control obviously forged that. I mean, the Thatcher years I always thought was a great educational experience for Scots, and you know, in 1979, the debate about having an assembly was a fairly arcane debate in many ways. But by the time you got to 1997, then there wasn't that many people in the country didn't realise it was actually quite important to have a parliament if you didn't want to have Margaret Thatcher on the poll tax again. So it related the constitutional issue to social and economic issues.
Scottish anti-Thatcherism may have begun as a response to traumatic economic change, but it also, on that very basis, stirred up an embattled sense of national difference. Indeed, Thatcher did more than any Scottish cultural figure to provoke a serious upsurge and re-examination of identity. Neil Asherson.
It's to do with this cry, which first went up, I think, in about 1981, about she hasn't got a mandate. You know, most people in Scotland didn't vote for her. At first, this didn't seem to be an important remark. Gradually, it did seem to be an important remark. And people began to say, yes, but Scotland is a political unit. It's a polity. It's a nation also in a political sense, and therefore what its majority wants must count somewhere. It can't count for nothing. And we are getting a government we didn't vote for.
To be sure, Scottish cultural renewal helped in the remaking of that we. It lent weight and authenticity to the possibility of a Scottish politics, one anchored in a recovered cultural past. But in my view, artists were more the conduits than the source of these energies. It was political rather than cultural developments which drove the change. So what is the story of devolution? Today and four decades ago, the boring details of devolution often jar with the deep passions it was intended to manage and contain. But devolution is about more than identity, and means something very different in the Kilbrandon Report and in back issues of Radical Scotland. There will always be more than one story for making sense of it, but it remains striking how little we, who inhabit the age of devolution, grasp how we got to where we are. That muddled middle course, unloved, undreamt, largely unstoried, has been our political reality for more than 15 years. It's time we looked squarely in the mirror and asked ourselves what devolution feels like and what it means. Both culturally and politically, devolution deserves more attention as a specific atmosphere in its own right. Without a stronger grasp of where and what Scotland is, and how we got that way, the debate over Scotland's future will lack a key element.